when you're designing a feature or designing a product, just handle the functionality that you need right now. Don't worry about what might come in the future or what might not be in the future, because oftentimes those things don't even come to pass. Hello everyone, welcome to the Non-Intuitive Bits, episode 12, right? Yeah.
Well, 12, yeah.
It's 12 already, man. So, I'm your host, Zane Rizvi, back after a long vacation, and with me is...
Slava! And come on, I know the truth, you just was super, super afraid to come back after what you did, right? Like, new name, new logo.
I was nervous about showing my face again, but fortunately we're separated with another state in the middle, so risk was lower. Yes.
Yeah, and I don't have any tactical rockets in my garage, so yes, you're safe.
They were all confiscated.
During the border crossing, yes.
So we've got a pretty cool lineup of topics today. So we're going to first talk about the Iowa voting issues. So there was and then after that, we will move on to a little bit of a holy war with whether or not monoliths are a good idea.
Looking forward. Oh, man. it's not a voting. It's just couscous, right? Or how do you call it?
For the Iowa thing?
Yeah,
it's not really voting. So basically what happened with the Iowa situation was that there was this one company that was hired to create software that would be used to count the votes. And so I'm not sure how the voting was done, but apparently this company wasn't used for the voting per se. But these guys, they're called Shadow Inc. So a very legit sounding company off the bat. Mm-hmm. They were creating an app. They're hired to create an app that would help the people who are running the voting centers quickly tally up the votes and be able to report.
You just done implicit assumption that there is no other country in the world except USA, which is nice assumption to have, like, for sure. But for the people from non-default countries, it might be nice to describe what caucuses are and how they...
Yes. Okay, fair enough. So in the US, we have our presidential elections in November. And for the two parties that we have, the Republican and Democratic parties, they have to decide who will be their presidential candidate. And so right now we have this voting going on for people to vote for who their preferred candidate will be for each party. And because of some crazy historical feature of American government, we vote first in Iowa, and Iowa is the only place where people have voted so far for their presidential candidates, and Iowa chose to use this one company's services for their to help them count the votes faster.
But this is not the per se voting. It's, if I remember, in the good old fashioned, it's done like you're going physically somewhere. There would be tables there, and like you need to sit within the table that support your candidate. Then would be local person who counting. If there would be no people enough on the tables, he will ask, "Oh, you need to rejoin other groups." So it's like something very, very informal. It's not like voting per se. Where you will
it
have,
depends. Like, every state is different.
Ah, I see.
Every state is different, and so some are like super, super informal, where you're almost just saying yays or nays in a room.
Okay.
Others are like less so, and I think some are just like full on, just you have a ballot, you submit the ballot. It completely depends on the state. They're completely free to choose how they want to do it. And I think even within the state, it's not even the state that decides it for the primaries, it's the individual parties that have their own process.
I see, because it's effectively process of selecting candidate who will be running. It's
exactly.
Nothing have to do with...
They're choosing the candidate who will represent the party.
Okay.
So that's why this scandal only affected the Democratic Party, because they were the ones who chose to use this app to aggregate the results.
Oh yeah, like I whatever you will get the Democrats, they will do this. Yes.
Yeah. So this the whole feature of this was supposed to be that, hey, you'll get your results faster. You'll be able to report the results faster to the state, and very, very quickly you'll be able to, the state will be able to say, hey, this candidate won the election within our state. And instead of that super fast process happening, everything took like multiple days, I think over a week, to actually figure out who got how many votes. And
why? What went wrong?
Well, there were a bunch of things that went wrong. So for the general idea was that all the people who are responsible for this counting, for this tallying, and they have to report the results, they would all get an app that they had to download on their phones. And when they would open that app, log into it, they would see the results right there in the app. Why was it not a website to begin with? I don't know. The developers thought it would be really cool to have an app. But people were told, here's how you install the app the day before the election.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in Rome, that wouldn't be that big of a deal, except this app was not available in the App Store. This was delivered via the app Beta Store.
Oh.
So first, people had to figure out, how do we install this in the Beta Store? And then when they're trying to log in, logging in wouldn't really work too well. Because this app was delivered through this other service called Test Fairy, which is some service that helps people test their apps and deploy them and whatnot. So Test Fairy has a free tier, and that's what they were using. They didn't use their tier, which came with SSO and other goodness. They wanted to use the free tier. And So there were a bunch of different things that were like going wrong along these lines. And this company, it's not really clear how they were chosen to run the election or to run this, do this ballot counting. But I mean, Iowa is not a tech hub. They're not the guys who know who's like really good at developing software. So they hired this company called Shadow. Mm-hmm. Shadow is owned by another company called Acronym. So they're going for as obscure names as possible. And it seems like these guys were basically hired to like build an app, but these guys were just cutting corners as much as they could. Now, cutting corners can be a nice thing in software development, because as long as you know which corners you're cutting and which ones are important to are cheap to cut and which ones are not, this was not exactly the right balancing act made over here.
To be fair, so let me reiterate the fact that we looks like learn from this. So there was tons of money allocated for
that's the funniest part. It wasn't tons of money. They were paid $60,000.
Oh, okay. Then effectively, this is actually pretty good execution. Like, it's okay. the article should be renamed the success of $60,000 project. Like, so they actually work. I'm surprised that it actually worked at all.
Yeah. I was actually surprised when I saw that $60,000 price tag. I was expecting this to be like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Millions
or millions,
that should
right?
be like $10 million. Yes, this size of the failure should be around 10. Do you remember how much it cost for Obamacare to build their website?
Oh yeah, that was like hundreds of millions, was it?
Yeah, that, so such
this,
failure usually
this
costs
is a really
that
cheap
amount.
Failure. That's true.
Yeah. Yes.
And the Test Fairy site is getting some like free publicity out of this, so it's really good. It's a win for them.
True. But I think we have almost zero exposure about actual technicality of these things, aren't we? So we probably have no idea what's technical went wrong there.
The actual technical stuff is, yeah, that's not really clear. The main thing that we know is that it was hard for people to install it, and then there were login issues. But the actual technical issues, we don't really know what's going on there. That's kind of all, that part's hidden.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we will ever know. Okay, to be fair, I have no idea what else to say here. The most interesting part for me was to learn how the election worked in USA.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm kind of like curious about how much of this was basically someone who was like friends or close enough to the government said, hey, I could build this for you. and just make me pay me this much, and then he just takes that money and then hires someone off of like Fiverr.com to build the app for him.
Yeah, pretty sure. I mean, yes, the actual developer probably is speaking in Russian or Ukrainian or Hindi, and probably right. That's why we will never learn how it works inside. Yes.
Yeah. So it is like a interesting bit on just kind of cost cutting in general. It's because there's many different types of costs that we tend to incur over the course of time. There's like costs related to making things more reliable, making things. Making the code more efficient. But there's all these different times where you have to basically choose where you're going to cut your costs and which costs are the ones that are good for you to cut. In this case, it's quite possible that the reason why this was distributed as an app instead of as a web app was because whoever was coding it knew how to make apps and they didn't know how to make websites.
To be fair, it's very consistent with overall movements in many, many states here in California as well, that says openly why these lazy people who call themselves software engineers had that high level of income. Why? and they lazy, don't do anything, they're only clicking on their keyboard and suddenly for what? So yeah, that's a reasonable outcome to cut their salaries, and yeah, sure, that's pretty much the result. but yeah,
that's kind of what happens when you have like something that actually is very high demand, but you don't quite understand why it's in high demand. You think everyone is basically interchangeable with each other. Yep. You say, hey, look, let me get the ones that we're not able to find, we're not actually in high demand.
Last time, so when in the old days, when communists came to the power in USSR, one of the main slogan, one of the among many, many slogans, they were saying that, I don't know how exactly translated, but something like, who was no one will be everyone, and even the cook can manage the government. This is effective when they done many, many things that led to replacing the government with people who never had experience actually leading government, but from the social layer, from the like.
Really?
They this was, to be fair, they get a lot of attraction specifically because of that. Even like in the army, they won army because they were saying that the private soldiers should lead the army by organizing in special committees, groups, and stuff like that, and not the officers. And yeah, so there was many, 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 many things back then. But the overall one with ideas was exactly that.
So how did that work out?
it's nice that you're asking the question. this, but you're the lucky one. Let me put it this way. It turns out well for some of the people.
yeah. Kind of going back to the cost cutting thing, like recently, because one of the costs that we tend to have to trade off on is choosing between reliability and shipping fast or shipping cheaply, which is one of the things that tends to cause people to go, hey, why are these developers like unable to do these kind of things? That's because why is the service down? That's a reliability versus dollars or something else trade-off. And I went to NASA recently, and they have a very different mindset in the reliability versus cost trade-off. And it's not really that they have a different mindset. They have the same mindset. But the cost of something failing is much, much, much higher for NASA than it is for us if our service is down for 1 hour. or just search for any cloud service. But like, I mean, they've got entire tens of billions of dollars on the line for a single mission. If it goes down, they've lost tens of billions of down on the of dollars, and not just that dollar amount. They've lost all the years that it took to launch that project. Because these projects tend to take decades, and not just to launch it, but for it to arrive at its destination for some of the longer lived space probes. So you're saying like 20 years of effort goes to waste if one space probe goes down before it needed to go down. So one of the really intense ways in which they've they try to reduce their risks and increase their redundancy is that every space vehicle or expedition that they have, every probe, every satellite, I think even, every rocket that's in space, they all have their own mission control room. Like you see in movies, the mission control rooms, it's not always the same room. Every mission has its own mission control room. So I mean, you're just kind of like separating out. So if the mission control room for one thing goes down, the other mission control rooms are unaffected. Okay, hey, that's cool. And they need to have someone in them 24/7 so that somebody is always in the room monitoring what's going on. But that wasn't the crazy part. Every mission control room has a duplicate backup mission control room, which is like just across the hallway from it usually. So that's like us at work having entire office space that's just sitting empty all the time, just in case our desks are unavailable during an outage. So.
By the way, out of curiosity, when you were speaking this, I have the same question again and again, and feel free not to answer this. How the hell you get to NASA? Like you just went and knocked on the door like, hey, NASA, I want in.
They have a public tours.
Oh,
so if you go to Houston, there's a Johnson Space Center, which is like it's open to the public. And I think it's like, I forget how much it costs, but it's not too expensive. It's pretty cheap, like 10, 20 bucks or something. Uh-huh. And you go there and they have like a full guided tour of NASA itself. Like, I mean, not the full NASA, but they take you to like a few big stops. And that's like it's like an hour and a half long tour. And then they have another museum and stuff inside there on top of that. So you get to see all these things while you're over there.
That is definitely now on my list. Now, coming back to the to what you mentioned, by the way, like if you look what SpaceX is doing, they actually taking that approach and doing it more iterative, more agile. Like look on how many rockets of SpaceX 9 got crashed along the way before because they actually trying to make it more iterative. And I think this is a huge sign that even the fields that you have to do it like that, and by that I mean waterfall style, even there they trying to match to move to agile as much as they can, but obviously like yes, you still staying in more waterfall kind of development. But I really like SpaceX because it shows that even there it's possible slowly to move to iterations.
You think that those crashes were that they were basically trying to create very cheap vehicles so that they could the crashes weren't as expensive to them?
No, I was saying that they were the crashes were expensive, but this was iteration. They never tried to create rockets from the first try. I do remember when they were landing the rockets in videos, they would say we have a probability 0.3 or 30% chances that it will land today. Then I do remember they would say 70%, and then finally they landed. But overall, they were doing this again and again, prototyping from a smaller step to finally launching to the orbit. And now, what I like about the SpaceX, if you know how you're going time to time to these IT enterprise companies and they will tell you here is our product, if you want pricing here is a call for our salespeople. If you go on the SpaceX, they will tell you we can deliver up to I think 100 kilogram minimum, $1 million prepay, then here is amount of dollars for extra kilogram, here is a schedule for lower orbit or high stationary orbit, and you can actually see on the website when the next flight will be. That is pretty amazing,
right? Yeah, that's really cool what you said about SpaceX. I didn't know that they were that iterative and that agile, because to do something like that you really need to lower the cost of each iteration, otherwise you're going to burn through money like crazy. So they must have been doing some stuff to just lower the cost of making it cheaper and cheaper to have a rocket fly and land again and fly and crash, and probably putting like absolute minimal components on there, maybe just filling it with like dead weight so that, and making the parts somehow reusable even potentially. I don't know.
You don't have to. So the thing is, when you're landing, you already deliver the cargo. So the only thing that you're losing effectively is if you look on the SpaceX actually comes in two modifications. One that one way only. because it's still the cheapest way to do one way. So they actually launching rockets that never reach back. And this is because if you actually want to get them back, you reducing amount of cargo. So you no longer can actually fulfill the full cargo. So effectively during the iteration cycle, when they was crashing the rockets, the only thing that they were losing is this weight that they have not fulfilled because they have engine that will try to bring it back. But the price for cargo delivering, they still got the money and they were losing some amount of money, but the whole world still flying one way. So
So you're saying that they would fly up, they would have a cargo that they were getting paid to deliver, they would deliver that cargo, and then they would try to land the rocket safely, but if that landing crashed after that, they were still okay because they had made a lot of money by just delivering the cargo. Which
I wouldn't say okay because they're losing money still a little bit.
Yeah, but yes. they basically made the iteration a lot cheaper for themselves because they were still delivering values. That's a really interesting hack, effectively.
Yep.
Because the principle that I was like saying earlier was that you have to make the iterations cheaper. And they made the iterations cheaper by finding someone who was willing to basically pay them for each iteration and get value out of each iteration.
Yep. Which I see this sign that if we think why this is happening, it's because by nature agile will be always more preferable, even in such industry where it seems inevitable to use waterfall, and still people try to find it.
Yeah, because I mean with agile, you're effectively, the difference between agile and waterfall is that with agile you have a much faster feedback loop. And the faster your feedback loop is, the faster you're going to learn and be able to adjust. Now, the only times you slow down your feedback loop are if you don't have a choice because you don't know how to get feedback, or in this case, like with NASA, the cost of failure is so high, you basically develop other ways to get feedback. They test their stuff on Earth before they launch it in the first place. So, I mean, they actually have shorter feedback loops in a different form. But for once the stuff is launched and it's into outer space and it's on its way to Pluto, there's no longer a chance of iterating at that point.
True. Yes, I mean, that is true. And I guess the industries like that, we will see less and less amount of such industries. And yes, space is still one of them. But even space, as we discussed earlier, slowly moving to agile. So inside of the space industry will be less and less project that cannot be agile. But yeah, I totally agree. There still will be plenty of them that has to be done only by waterfall. And even that, just think about the fact that a lot of old vehicles in the space that are there are remotely updatable. So even that already embedded to allow iterate you as you go.
Right. And I guess like in a sense, agile and waterfall aren't really choices. They're more like distributions on a spectrum of how quickly you can get feedback on what you're doing, on your development process. So waterfall is kind of like one extreme end. Agile is getting closer towards more frequent updates. And then there is the holy grail where you submit code and it immediately goes to prod. I only test my code in prod.
to be fair, full CI/CD doesn't mean that you have testing. Don't have testing.
That's true, yeah. Testing is the real field. Yeah, that's a different thing. This is about how quickly you get feedback. Just shipping to prod does not necessarily mean you're getting feedback.
So what you're saying, which is completely true, the truth and the best way is always somewhere in between extremes. And that being said, we actually have another topic about two extremes. just if you want to shift there.
Yeah. So the next topic is monoliths. Are they a good thing or not? And Kesley Hightower, he recently posted an article called, or actually this is an excerpt from a podcast that he had. And that excerpt's called "Monoliths Are the Future. Microservices Are a Thing of the Past."
Okay. Who out of us two want to be the devil's advocate?
I can take that role.
Okay. Okay.
So you can advocate. Well, actually, now first you have to ask, who is the devil here? That's a matter of perspective.
Is it even a question in 2020? Like it's
for it's our like, listeners, maybe.
Okay.
If this article, sure. If the title of this article was a surprise to you, then this article is the devil.
Yes. It came as a surprise for me. But to be fair, I've seen lately many people who used to be a good practitioners who converted to purely theoretical sites, start writing things that are hard to digest. I do remember Uncle Bob, I think, if I remember correctly, wrote an article how to convert monolith to microservices. And like you're reading and you clearly get understanding that whoever wrote this never actually implemented it. Like you can feel it, like see that no, this person haven't done anything with his or her hand for the last year.
Maybe you can do that. I read that article 3-4 years ago and I was really impressed.
Okay, tell me, then you know the article. Tell me, my friend, out of these 3 years, which big mature monolith you rewrote to a service microservice architecture?
Oh, which one did I rewrite to a microservice? Well,
mature that has a usage that, yes, you re-implemented.
But it's not my fault. My boss never gave me the budget to do that.
Sure. Here is what I'm saying. The person who wrote that article clearly never done anything because, real life, it's real life.
Yeah, real life, the spaghetti doesn't separate quite as easily.
You don't have budget if it works. There is so many problems. No, it's just not how things work. But coming back to this
article, what if you're not going to convert your monolith into a microservice? What if you're just building something new and you're using microservices of that time?
So what's the question, sorry?
So would you object to using microservices from the get-go? Actually, maybe first we should define microservices.
First of all, let me say this way. So canonical microservices is a function, logical independent function, stateless, that performs one logical action. That's it. To be fair, I never in my life implemented service with microservices. So I effectively usually have a set of services that I don't want to call micro, because now some of our listeners who actually knows what microservices was, that is not the microservice. You've been unhonest. So effectively, we should be careful by saying this. And to be fair, when I in my following conversation, when I will be saying microservices, I referring to just multi-service architecture, not multi-microservice. I don't think that microservice is very good, well-defined architecture type. And I also don't think that many people who saying they doing microservices even know that they what they doing. They probably also doing service architecture, not microservices.
Yeah, this is one of those scenarios, again, like you mentioned, where service size is really a spectrum, and you can get bigger or you can get smaller, and at some arbitrary point in the middle, which is not really well definable, we kind of start calling it microservices instead of just normal services. And
slightly disagree, but go for it.
I mean, at some point they start getting considered microservices, and like where that line exists is going to be different for different people. And even the monoliths, which are the other extreme, at some sense could be considered, like if they're also service-based architectures. We just by convention say, hey, they're not microservices, but they're still services that are using other services, usually. No, they're not always. I guess the real monolith would be where everything lives on one machine and it doesn't have to make API calls to any other service for anything, including its database. That would be the ultimate monolith right there.
I still think that general philosophy in both monolith and microservices, the couple database and logic. They deliberately in both cases, I never seen the idea to combine in one place. It's either the whole controlling logic inside of one huge monolith, or it's inside of different services, but data layer in both cases. It's a question that
maybe call this one the megalith.
Megalith. Okay, yes, yes, it's our invention. Yes. And to be fair, I don't think we should be, because the way how you mentioned that this is a scale, I agree, but still, more or less, I don't want to call computer science because it's not yet a science, but the definition are more or less actually stable there. So micro would, anyone who advocate microservices will tell you that this is very well-defined, smallest possible entity that is stateless, that can talk to database. Therefore, if you making something bigger, it's by definition probably will not be microservice.
But I agree, I would argue that even the idea of a smallest possible component is very ambiguous.
Agree.
Because what if you need to add two numbers? Do you need to call another service that just adds two numbers? That's an even smaller component.
Yeah, I like the idea. I mean, yes. We're speaking with purely theoretical. Yes, like why not?
So in practice, every microservice is like at some level a small monolith that's being delivered, and you're just kind of like limiting the scope of however many features it takes care of to a whatever you consider to be a reasonable extent.
Yeah, I know, but we're kind of creating abstraction that's as abstract that no longer useful. But yes, I agree with you. In my mind, the clear example of microservice would be Lambda, AWS Lambda, which is one function, one input, one output, one action. It can talk to database easily.
That is a pretty popular example of microservices. Like that's one example, and then the other, like that's like in my mind, that's the most extreme example that is put in practice. Mm-hmm. And then the less extreme version are when you have microservices deployed on Kubernetes, which tend to be, each microservice tends to be, have a lot more functionality than a Lambda function. It has like, it usually has like multiple APIs that it exposes, a mm-hmm. few different things that it offers. Like it might be just an authentication module, for example. So mm-hmm. it's more full featured than just a Lambda function, but it's still generally considered to be a microservice. At least no. in my mind.
Yes, this considering, but it's not it by actually definition if you dive to microservices, I think. I actually don't, I can't recall the correct definition, but in my mind it's not, but I don't remember exact definition. But let's call it, for the sake of this discussion, just service architecture. To avoid listeners saying if these are or not microservices, for the sake of this conversation, when we're saying microservices, forget for micro. We're just saying service architecture, even if we're using word micro. Let's cut to the chase.
Sure.
Where we should start?
So let's just define the service architecture, then our micro, our version of this, as mm-hmm. any service that a team is running, where internally that service uses multiple different services. So you might have like an authentication mm-hmm. version and a, I don't know, modifying customer information level, or like modifying customer data level.
Yes, so you have fully independent logical bits that you can deploy separately, that you can test separately, that has asynchronous ways of communication between each other, and that has zero common source code that is extracted. And yeah, you shouldn't have, you know, when I see this, the first time someone who never wrote the microservices would do. That person would create a common library with common database layer access that accessing the same table as other components, then build a pipeline that strictly releases everything in order, and have so many dependencies that you literally cannot just deploy one part to another or change database on the fly.
They're still coupled to each other.
Yes, that is, I see so many times someone would do it and say, oh, I have microservices. I'd be like, oh man, better stay with monolithic.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of goes back to like, what is the goal of microservices? Why are microservices supposed to be good? And that's kind of like, if you don't understand why microservices are supposed to be good and what you need to preserve that goodness, then you end up with this kind of a situation. Because if you're service cannot be independent or is likely to not be independent of each other, And if it's very closely coupled to the implementation of another service, then it's basically not independent. This is not just why microservices are good. This is why service-based architectures are good.
Yeah, as I said, we're using micro, but we're saying, well, service.
Yeah, micro is really just like how far you want to take the service-based architecture model and how small of a service can you make where it's useful, where the service-based architecture is useful. How many components can you usefully split up into separate services? That's really what microservices are about, or that philosophy is about.
So tell me why monolithic is our future, because I know why service architecture is our future.
I thought we were going to take the other roles.
You want me to protect monolithic?
I can take the other one. But okay, I can take the other role. I think when people are doing microservices, we don't quite understand microservices. Like we right now, you and I, we had this long discussion about what a microservice even means. And we're fairly well versed in the industry, relatively speaking. But there's this confusion about what makes a microservice. It's an ambiguous thing. And because it's ambiguous, people have different ideas about what it is, what it should be, and you don't really understand what makes the best practices for one thing or another. What are really good quote unquote service based architecture is if you have one app, one monolith effectively, and that monolith is making API calls to different services in Google Cloud, Azure, AWS, Auth0, all these other services that are out there. Those other services are your quote unquote microservices. Not really. Your team doesn't own them. But that's why they stay uncoupled to you. So when people are that's kind of like the mindset that microservices are great when you have completely independent pieces of functionality that other people might want to reuse. If you don't have that, then it's a lot more questionable what value you're going to get out of it.
So let me ask you this. I will try to.
So I can argue the other side too, but.
I will try by asking you questions to change your mind.
Okay, please do.
So, do you agree that irrespectively of monolithic or service architecture, you can end up having complete shit that's completely unsupportable?
Of course.
Yeah, it's a hobby of engineers to do such projects. And that is, but now the second
question. You've got to make the wrong trade-offs.
Yes. Now, the question, would you agree that it's much simple to make a horrible nightmare out of monolith?
I would say that it is easy to make a nightmare out of any situation that you're in.
Easier. It's much easier.
Easier.
Yep.
Well, I would compare to having 10 services versus one service, but by definition, no. You've got more places to inject complexity and horribleness in a microservice that you have in a monolith. It depends on how well you've kept the code bases separate. You could effectively have 10 microservices that all share 90% of the same code, but they just have different API layers.
Where
they have a giant common library that is shared by all of them that does all the logic, and it's just the API level for the 10 microservices that are different.
No, we had a definition, so it should be testable, deployable, changeable, independently. So if you have a common layer and like common library, this means that by introducing bug in one services, you can break another, which by definition,
not necessarily, because if it's testable, debuggable, deployable independently, that's fine. I wrote a bug in the common layer. I deployed it to microservice A, and microservice A is updated. It didn't change the interfaces between A and B. And microservice A develops bugs. I fix the bugs. But the buggy code, like B's code base, now has the bug in it. But I haven't deployed it to B. I didn't have to deploy it to B. I was able to deploy it and test it to A, just to A.
The fact that you don't know that you impacted B doesn't mean that you have not impacted. You impacted service B by changing service A.
I impact service B when it's deployed, but the specific thing you said that it has to be tested and deployed independently is still there. It's still like...
No, I have not said when. You said when it's been deployed, sure, like, but I haven't said when. But if you want really, really to be specific, okay, let's say that they sharing zero common source base.
So they're not sharing operating system updates either?
That is not your code base.
It's a dependency tree.
It's a dependency tree. No, they don't have to share the same. One can run to Debian container, now to Ubuntu.
They don't have to, but my point is that they still have dependencies that they share. There's still issues that can affect, like, if you update your operating system, or you have an operating system, that operating system will affect any issues with the OS, will affect all your layers.
Yeah, but I specifically mentioned they have zero shared code base, your code base. But yeah, you're right. You might be deploying on the same Kubernetes cluster.
Okay, so you're now extending the definition of microservice to something that has a shared code base.
Don't have a shared code.
That does not have a shared code base.
Yeah, because in my mind that violates deployable, testable, independent. But nevertheless, I'm okay to disagree here. So let's introduce this additional field. Do not have shareable code base.
Okay, so now this is getting interesting. So now we're making this be a microservice that's implemented really cleanly, because you have no shared code base. So this is like become one of the ideal microservices right now.
Why ideal? I'm not saying it. So I'm not saying this should be really small. But for example, if you have a I'm not saying it should be small. You still can have it reasonably big services, but they should have their own database. This happens me in the, for example, this helped me in the past a lot. When just because I would have a completely different tables, obviously I would have one database, but because I would have completely different tables, which effectively represents the same entities, but in different stages of processing, I can easily pinpoint at which particular table data got corrupted and pinpoint back to particular submodels. And this would not be possible in monolithic, because in monolith by design you mutating data in place. I never seen anyone saying in monolithic when they, for example, just to give you an example, you need to do a counter of particular you need to enrich data from the raw data records that you have at let's say you have a timestamp, and you need to enrich the data saying how this timestamp look in Russian specifically, right? So in multi-services world, you actually might have a database, a separate table that will request through the HTTP list of this timestamp, then enrich it and save it in completely different table. And now tables represent steps in your pipeline. Instead of the classical approach would be to have two columns, and one column would raw data, another column would be enriched data, and if any part of your monolithic screwed up, you literally have no idea which part, because you're mutating data in place. So yeah, they should have zero any commonality, including obviously database layer and layer that gets data, reads data, updates data, including model. And I usually do this way.
So you're saying each of your services has its own independent database?
Table. It's never database. Yeah, neither I have done, neither I have seen that people would use for one microservices MySQL, for another Mongo. It always will be Mongo, but the tables, yes. And the permissions of services will be granted the way that they cannot see each other's tables.
Okay. Now, I mean, that's if that's a way that could work. I mean, that's at the extreme. Like, you take that, you basically have cloud services. Each one is an independent cloud services in the Slava cloud.
Yep.
And now, I think when people are objecting to microservice architectures and they have strong objections to it, what they're really objecting to is the fact that it takes a lot of design and upfront planning, like in discipline, to keep those code bases clean. And in the real world, like, either you have the different teams who are responsible for every single code base, or people often tend to be tempted to add that shared code, which you say makes it not be a service-based architecture anymore.
So let me make a statement. Much harder to mess up the code of microservices, sorry, of service architecture, and much harder because you still can do all this mess that they described. You can do a common layer. It's way harder to do it in service architecture where you actually need to extract library, rebuild CI, rebuild tons of the thing, than in monolithic. In monolithic, it's just one swipe in your IDE, done. You have a mess. Congratulations. Like that's why I really like service architecture. You need actually work hard to make it a mess.
Oh, but yeah, that's the way in which you're saying it's easier or it's harder in a service architecture. Okay.
You still can do it. Like you can try, but by nature, even if I have a junior developer working in one sort of these services, that is isolated.
Like, and, I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, I'm thinking about code bases I've actually worked in. Uh-huh. It was like we kind of had a internal service-based architecture at uh-huh. one team where uh-huh. our service had like five different services internal to our service. And it was pretty easy to just create. We already had a common library that was shared by all of them. So if we wanted to, it was easy to just stick stuff more, like move stuff from a normal library into the common library. You would argue that the common library was a failure in the first place. It wasn't service-based microservice because the common library already existed. But adding a new common library was really simple. You just create a new library, have everyone you care about import that library, and move whatever functions you want into the common library. So it wasn't all that hard.
You have many assumptions here that's in practice time to time true, time to time not, like everyone using same language, everyone wants in the same, live in the same monolithic repository, and this old assumption true if you're from the big companies, but even in big companies, we're working with you, my friend, on very, very complex things. How many languages we're using on the same service today? I can quickly name four different, and we actually have a very successful microservices architecture that has zero common things in place, zero common libraries that very well tuned to work together, very well defined, very well isolated, and you can literally onboard new developers on particular subpart of the thing because of that.
It's interesting calling our stuff a microservice-based architecture.
Service-based.
Or service-based architecture. Yes. I mean, we have independent components, yes. We could have gone a pure monolith route where all these components were one big thing. It was not possible to separate it out.
One proto that rules them all, that describes everything.
Right.
One database, one logic, maybe even the same language, who knows? I don't know if you possible because some of backend, some of the front, but they may maybe even like, God forbid, Java or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this kind of all... This is interesting what you're saying. I never thought of our notebook service as a service-based architecture. Because, like, in my mind, we have one service. Then we offer images, container images, and VM images that people can go use with another service that is owned by somebody else. And we make it, but mm-hmm. we make the process really, really easy.
Mm-hmm.
The UI is effectively like its own service.
Mm-hmm. Viewer its own service.
Viewer is its own service, that's true.
Scheduler its own service.
Yeah, these are independent services, you're right.
Completely independent, and even teams are independent.
Yeah, and that is where it seems to get like I wouldn't call the VM and I mean I guess those the VM and
it's
container
product.
Services,
it's product.
But the viewer and scheduler definitely are.
VM and containers is still a product, and if you look on them from the monolithic perspective, that would be your environment that always part of the any monolith. Monolith has environment for deploying, for debugging, for developing, and this always part of this monolithic schema.
Right. Huh, that's an interesting perspective. I'd forgotten about the other two at the moment.
Exactly, because you can focus on one particular part and you can be really good in that particular part, which consequence of having service-focused architecture in the first place, which wouldn't be possible otherwise.
And this is where we come into, you have one team that tends to own one service, and the different services are owned like kind of independently of each other.
Later on, not the first place. You can later be an owner of all of them, yes, in the beginning, but this pays out almost immediately when you're hiring your second engineer. That I've seen again and again and again and again. When you're hiring the first engineer, you now can pick and says, here is the spot in this huge map, learn it, just this spot. And that would be starting point. If the person, at some point you will get the feeling when the new person no longer can learn all the map. Sure, that is fine. That is the time to draw the line and said, here is part one, part two, you will own only part one. Yeah, and there you go.
Yeah, I think where we're converging is when you're deploying a service, there's a big spectrum of areas where you could be. You could be at a pure single monolith. You could be at tiny, tiny microservices where each service is like no bigger than a Lambda function. Mm-hmm. And there's a really wide spectrum in the middle. And you need to be careful about where it is on the spectrum that you find the right balancing act. Because, I mean, the common criticisms of like microservices generally are that they add a lot of overhead. You have to learn Kubernetes, you have to learn to understand containers, or you have to figure out how to deploy Lambda services effectively. Those are all overhead items which are not necessarily, don't necessarily have to be there. If, for example, you're just deploying directly to cloud VMs, and that's one set of cloud VMs is one service, a different set of cloud VMs is a different service, mm-hmm. People would I think people would sometimes consider those to be two monoliths today, but the definition of a monolith is kind of based on your perspective. If you're one person owning both of these things, they seem like two different services. If you're one person who owns one thing, from your perspective, your one service is a monolith, and the other guy's service is a service that you happen to use, or maybe a service that you have nothing to do with.
Sure, but the Kels specifically advocate to have monolith as almost extreme that you described, because his idea is actually everything in one place, one giant project. He's not saying that you should be on this scale closer to that. No, he tells you just call class, call methods, sub functions, I don't know, whatever, how do you want to call it? Yes.
Yeah, it's not a... The debate on this topic tends to not be very nuanced. It's like it's a false binary that is always being mentioned, that you either are microservice or you're a big monolith. That the fact that these two things are a wide spectrum is really not brought up that much.
Yeah. Anyway, I think let's do a quick time check.
I think we're at pretty much at time right now.
Yes, I think it was amazing talk, and I think it was amazing talk. And so, what's the conclusion? By the way, you are the horrible devil's advocate. Like I haven't heard any reasons why to use monolith.
Well, I from my perspective. We started off by saying defining microservices as, well, you were originally defining microservices as Lambda functions. So I think you yourself, your own examples were not Lambda functions.
True, yeah.
I got confused in the middle. Which side are you taking, Slava?
Okay, I was a horrible advocate of another side as well, sure. Yes. Okay, so where we can, so what the conclusion? What's the, are we unintuitive bits, right?
Non-intuitive bits.
non-intuitive bits. Yeah, so tell me what non-intuitive bits is approved way.
Well, first of all, this is not an either or situation.
Usually it's the either or. When you're starting a service that you don't know much about, you need to start from something. You cannot jump ship later.
You need to jump ship later, but you have to basically design your thing ahead of time. Then you figure out, hey, what are reasonable sized components to carve out? Because in our case, when we first started, we only had one service. We didn't have like three services that we were launching, but we started with one service. And then as we thought, hey, we want to add this other bit of functionality, we made a trade-off. Hey, for the scheduler, is this functionality similar to what we have before? Or hey, would it be easier to launch this as a separate service? Muir was the same way. We said, hey, do we piggyback on what we have right now? Or do we create a new service? And was that going to make more sense at the time? So it was kind of like on an ongoing basis as we were adding more features that we thought, hey, would this make sense to add as a separate service? Or would this make sense to keep as a standalone thing? And if you're making something ahead of time, that trade-off can be a bit harder to make, and you're kind of dealing with a bit of unpredictability based on what you think is going to grow and faster, what you think is going to be more stable.
So what you said, that we decide to proceed with microservices each time we build the next service, I don't remember it's ever been a question if we need to keep adding to existing one.
Right. I mean, in our situation, it was always would have been so hard to add on to the existing one. I don't think it was a very easy choice to make.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. This is the same talk that I remember from 10 years ago when people were saying, are it NoSQL or relational database? And I was saying, go with NoSQL. Like, this is just a future. You will not go back, because even if you're starting first table NoSQL, it will be hard to actually go back. The same is here. If you start with microservice philosophy, you build the service in the way that it's not designed to handle all possible future cases. It's not scalable for many of the cases. It's only scales for one use case. You will inevitably end up giving a new microservice. And the only thing that you need to choose in the beginning, do you actually want to have architecture that scales beyond functionality that you have now? And you will have to put way more thought. Similar like relational database or NoSQL. For relational database, you need to have a front scalable schema. So otherwise, you will end up. Yep. Sorry.
Sounds like really what you're saying is, when you're designing a feature or designing a product, just handle the functionality that you need right now. Don't worry about what might come in the future or what might not be in the future, because oftentimes those things don't even come to pass.
Yep. Exactly. Yes. Yep. That is exactly.
And that, that might be a great point to end this podcast on. I think we've agreed on something.
yep, finishing it, my friend.
Well, this has been a really fun chat. Great podcast. Thanks a lot, Slava.
Thank you, Zane.
And to all of our listeners, we will see you next time on the Non-Intuitive Bits.
See you next time.
And if you can, if you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Rate us on iTunes. It helps us spread the word. So thank you very much and see you next time.
Oh, if you don't like us, don't rate us, but still tell your friends. They might like it.